We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. willpledge.org. Now here's your program.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. For her most recent book, naturalist Lyanda Lynn Haupt trained her gaze upon crows and the urban landscape. She knew crows were social and smart. What came as a surprise? They're a lot like us. Haupt is the author most recently of Crow Planet, Essential Wisdom from the Urban Wilderness. Lyanda Lynn Haupt hadn't planned on writing a book on crows, but once she started thinking about them, she says she couldn't shake them. She says she's confident that this claim is true. Crows are the most common native wild being that humans regularly see. She also reports that crow populations are booming and, in her words, mirroring with uncanny exactness human population growth. Lyanda Lynn Haupt is a writer and naturalist. She's created and directed educational programs for Seattle Audubon. She's also worked in raptor rehabilitation and as a seabird researcher for the Fish and Wildlife Service in the remote tropical Pacific. Her previous books are Pilgrim on the Great Bird Continent and Rare Encounters with Ordinary Birds. Her new book, Crow Planet, is published by Little Brown. Lyanda, welcome. How are you?
Hi, Celeste. I'm very well. Thank you for having me today.
My pleasure. When you finished writing Rare Encounters with Ordinary Birds, it seems you thought you were finished with crows.
I did think I was finished with crows, and the editor of that book suggested a book about crows, and I thought, no, I'd written a crow chapter for Rare Encounters, and that was it. But in a way, it's sort of like someone telling you not to think about elephants. It just kept coming back. And I went to work on my next book about Darwin, and almost without me even realizing it, the ever more interesting crow research kept piling up on my desk. Injured crows started turning up on my doorstep, and the crow book started to become inevitable.
Yeah. There's a moving passage early in the book where you tell readers how it was a crow pulled you from your bed at a time when you were feeling really low. Would you tell a story?
I will, and this is a story that really changed the shape of the book Crow Planet, which started out as sort of a summary of crow natural history and lore and that kind of thing. What happened was we had recently bought our second house in Seattle, so sort of a Seattle neighborhood in the city. I had never intended or imagined myself to be an urban dweller. I have been a student of the natural world my whole life, and all my work has been around sort of the study of nature. And I imagined that I would raise my daughter in some sort of rural haven, you know, with meadows and woodlands, and we'd have a cow and be barefoot. And so buying my husband's work is with the university here in Seattle, and he does global AIDS work. It's good work that we want to support as a family, and so that's why we chose to stay in the city. But buying our second house here made me realize that, you know, wow, I really am going to be living here. And I did fall into a very deep melancholia at this time. And one day, my husband and daughter, you know, went on their way to work and school, and I was here huddled and depressively in my pajamas, which is very unusual for me as the day wore on. And I heard this incessant cawing outside of my study window in the next room, and I pulled the covers over my head and tried to ignore it, but it just went on, and I finally got up and looked out the window, and there was just one crow on the wire beyond my study, just about 12 feet from the window, and I I could not say that it was alone. There didn't seem to be, you know, a raccoon or anything bothersome going on. And I thought, what is it calling about? So I tapped the window, tap. It looked up at me, and I don't want to anthropomorphize, but in my imagination, the look on the crow's face was, ha, I got her out of bed. And so I kind of forgot about everything else and started taking some notes on the crow, which turned to sort of really preening its feathers as if it was, I thought it was bothered by some kind of ectoparasites bothering its skin. So I was watching this, and it was in that moment that I kind of thought to myself, all right, you know, what do I think that I want, or what do I think that I'm missing? You know, here in front of me is this quite lovely, intelligent, native, wild bird. And if I studied it for the rest of my life, I would only be scratching the surface of what could be known about it. Mm. Here in my urban place, I'm an introduced a race as a Norway rat, you know, and here's this native wild creature. So it was in that moment that instead of just being the object of my study, crows became a kind of guide to more deeply and graciously, I guess, inhabiting my urban home and seeing it as a way to connect to the wild natural world.
Yeah. One of the things you say early in the book is that it's important that we not think of nature as something out there and as being in a place removed from us. Why is that important?
Well, it's true. We usually think of nature as someplace that we go, you know, that we put on special hiking shoes and we pack a bag and we go there and then we return back to, you know, the grind or the work week until, you know, looking forward to the next time we can get back to nature. And the harm in this view is that, you know, now in a time of ecological crisis in which we live, we hear so often about ecological thinking, ecosystemic thinking. But what makes us ecosystemic creatures is not the times that, the rare few times that we're able to go and enjoy the more pristine wild, but it's the same thing that makes any organism an ecosystemic creature. The way that we consume food, use water, share the places upon which we live, create and dispose of waste, these are all the elements, the active elements of a household and an ecosystem. And so although I think that that these sustaining moments when we can get out of the city and get to someplace more wild that sustains us, you know, psychically and aesthetically, I think these times are essential, we have to realize that if we want to conserve those places, if we love those places, then our best way of connecting to them is through the choices we make in our everyday lives in the homes in which we live.
Mm. Would you read a portion of your thinking here that you explore in the book Crow Planet with us? Would you share that with our listeners?
Sure, and this is a section that sort of that follows on the story that I just told about the crow getting me out of bed. I used to cling tightly to a chimeric vision of nature as something pure and somehow prehuman, and to the idea that anything human-made removed a place from its natural status. But I have come to understand nature differently. Surely there is a continuum from a pure, undefiled wilderness to a trammeled concrete industrial area. But there is no place we now know, as the relentlessly global impacts of climate change become increasingly understood, that humans have left untouched. And there is no place that the wild does not, in some small way, proclaim itself. Many human activities are wholly ugly, working against the nature upon which we forget we depend. Still, we do not flip-flop back and forth, now in nature, now in culture, now feeling quite animal-like, now wholly intellectual. We are, at all times, both at once. In this, humans may be unique, but we are no less natural. We are the human species, living in culture, bound by nature. When we allow ourselves to think of nature as something out there, we become prey to complacency. If nature is somewhere else, then what we do here doesn't really matter. Jennifer Price writes in Flight Maps, her eloquent critique of romanticized nature, that modern Americans use an idea of nature out there to ignore our ravenous uses of natural resources. She writes, "If I don't think of a Volvo as nature, then can't I buy and drive it to nature without thinking very hard about how I use, alter, destroy, and consume nature? In my urban ecosystem, I drive around a corner and a crow leaps into flight from the grassy parking strip. We startle each other. If nature is out there," she asks, "then what am I?" And I have to tell you, Celeste, at this moment in reading, I'm always very grateful for my editor, because the way that I had written it the first time was, "If nature's out there, then what am I? Chopped liver?" And she took her red pencil and said, "I think we get the idea." The editors still really do edit.
Yeah.
Shall to the end of this passage? Or
Let's pause there.
Okay.
Because I've got a couple of listeners already who would like to talk with you. But anyway, your editor has a great writer to work with.
Oh, thank you very much.
Lyanda Lynn Haupt is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. She's the author most recently of Crow Planet, Essential Wisdom from the Urban Wilderness. Let's go and take a call from a listener in nearby Belgium on line 4. Good afternoon.
Yes, good afternoon. I'm sorry, I'd like to get away from your description reading there a little bit, but I'd like you to define crow, because you know, around here we have what we call crows might actually be blackbirds, because aren't crows very large and, you know, more like a turkey instead of a small bird?
Not quite as big as a turkey, but that is a good question. There are several species of crows in the world. In North America, the most common crow is the American crow. And so usually when people speak of crows colloquially, that's the bird that they're talking about. So the bird is, crows are in the family called the corvids, and that includes the ravens, which are much larger than crows, the crows, and then the jays. So depending on where you live, you'd have scrub jays, pinion jays, Steller's jays, as we have here in the Northwest, and blue jays. So these birds are all very closely related. The jays are about the size of a robin, a little bit bigger, and the crows are a little bit bigger yet. And it's true that a lot of people confuse them with blackbirds. So again, blackbirds would be the robin-sized birds. Sometimes they have a color on them. Sometimes they have yellow eyes. So it's a confusion worth clearing up, because when we talk about the corvid group, of which the crows are a part, we're talking about a group that has a particular set of behaviors and intelligence that is rare in other songbirds. And they are songbirds, so I don't want to get too deep into avian taxonomy here, but the songbirds is a colloquial name for the large order of passerine birds that includes everything from the raven down to the little, wrens and bush tits and warblers, and includes birds as varied as the thrushes, like the robin, and the blackbirds. And the corvids are a group that are related to all those birds, but they're related, the separate group that's related to one another are the jays, crows, and ravens.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. And I think, was the caller finished? Yeah, okay. Line 1, we're going to go next to a caller in DeWitt County. Hi.
Yeah, good afternoon. I'm going to bring up a couple of situations. First is reference. I read a book when I was a child about a man, his experiences with crows, where they could tell the difference between when he was carrying a rifle and a cane, and would fly away with a rifle and not bother with a cane. And the other recently in the news about that researcher in Harvard or someplace where proved that crows can recognize faces. So these guys are really smart. But going back in lore, crows are supposed to be harbingers of war. I'm wondering if this just their observational power would lead them to recognize that when a bunch of guys are, putting on swords and marching in a large group, that there's going to be carrion to feed on. Is that where that observation comes from?
Right. That actually is where that observation comes from. ever since the Renaissance Wars of Europe, all the way up through the American Civil War, when it was our, I don't know what you'd want to say, technology or resources for disposing of bodies were still very limited, crows did understand that following soldiers into battle was a way to ultimately scavenge the meat of bodies. It's a horrific image, but it's one that has cemented in the human psyche the idea of crows being connected with death. It's one of the reasons. Another is the Black Plague, the bubonic plague in Europe, when bodies, again, were not able to be immediately disposed of. So they were piled sometimes just in the streets or outside of homes. And again, so people would see their loved ones being eaten by crows. Horrific image. So that is one of the sources of the cross-cultural and cross-time association between crows and death.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Toll-free 800-222-9455. If you've got a question or a comment about crows, our guest this afternoon, naturalist Lyanda Lynn Haupt, author of Crow Planet, Essential Wisdom from the Urban Wilderness. Well, it seems people have strong opinions about crows.
It's true, and I was really surprised when I was doing the research just for the chapter on my first book that was about crows. I didn't. My editor wanted me to write about crows, and I wasn't really sure what I had to say. Although I had observed crows, I think more closely than normal people, because I've been a student of bird life since I was very young. I didn't have a sense of what I wanted to write in that essay, so I started talking to just friends and people on the street, not particularly naturalist or bird watcher oriented people, and I was so shocked at the depth and the vehemence of the responses that I received. You know, it's so funny, if you ask somebody about a robin or a chickadee, the response is very bland. I mean, really, what is there to say? They're cute. People are happy to have them around. But when you ask about crows, there are people that love crows, sort of fall into raptures and about how beautiful and how, they dream in crows and how intelligent they are. More often, there's an absolute hatred of crows, people that see them as a pestilence on the city, people that call them evil, which is a strange and very strong word to use in conjunction with a bird. And I can hardly think of any other bird that people would call evil. And among many people, though, there's also sort of a vague kind of uneasiness about crows. When there's too many crows in one place, they feel like they can't walk there with small children, or there's a sense of some kind of ominousness that they can't describe. And it seems like no matter what people think or have to say about crows, almost everyone respects the idea that crows have intelligence, that behind those pretty amber eyes they have, that they're knowing things of some kind. So you're right. The human response to crows runs unusually deep for a bird.
How and why did a flock of crows become known as a murder of crows?
Do you know, I should know that, and I don't know the answer to that question. I'm sure. I imagine that it's associated with the longstanding association between crows and death, but I doubt that it's associated with an actual murder.
Right. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Lyanda Lynn Haupt, our guest this afternoon, author most recently of Crow Planet, Essential Wisdom from the Urban Wilderness. Well, we know these birds are smart, and someone you quote in the book is of the opinion that they're smarter than African grays.
That's really interesting, an interesting quote. So John Paul Barrett, the author of a small and quite wonderful self-published book, raised several crows. Somehow a young crow came to him, and after that, whenever someone found a crow they believed to be orphaned or whatever, they brought it to him. And he had also raised African gray parrots. And African grays, of course, are sort of flagship example of avian intelligence and have been held up as being, rivaling the intelligence of primates. And what Barrett said, having raised both grays and crows, he said, the crows made our African grays look like morons. So I apologize to any African gray fans, and it's not my own quote, but that's what he said.
Yeah, so how is intelligence in birds measured?
You know, that is a really good question. And it's something that's undergoing a lot of revision. There's actually a consortium of scientists from several universities called the Avian Brain Nomenclature Consortium. And they're working to change the names of the parts of the avian brain, because in the past, the parts of the avian brain have been named in a fashion similar to the ways that we name the parts of the reptilian brain, which we know to have a simpler functioning. And so we saved the names for the parts of the brain that are similar to ours to other animals that we presume to have higher intelligence, like the primates and the other higher mammals. And now we're recognizing that the avian brain functions in a way that's very similar to the ways that we've limited before to animals that we consider to be most like us. And so there's a movement among scientists to sort of come to a consensus that we recognize this, starting with just the basic fact of the way we name the physical parts of the brain. So that's really interesting. But one of the problems, I think, with measuring avian intelligence is that we're prone to use the yardstick of primate intelligence. And so there's some research that I talk about in my book where researchers at Cambridge collected a lot of different work from different authors and find by sort of gleaning all this different research that crows and other corvids think in a way that's similar to the way that primates think, so that they say they have the same cognitive toolbox. So in other words, they use forethought, they use imagination, they have flexibility in response to a situation, so a new situation. So instead of just responding by instinct, they can sort of think about what to do and have a great plasticity of behavior. And that's all wonderful. You know, it makes us think, oh great, crows think like primates. That means they're really smart. And I think it invites us to think differently about non-human animal consciousness in general, more expansively. But what I would love to see as the next step is for us just to drop that primate yardstick altogether, you know, that to admit that non-human, non-mammalian, non-primate animals have an intelligence in their own right, that we don't have to measure it against primate intelligence to call it intelligence, that there may be other ways of knowing that we don't use ourselves or necessarily understand. And I think that once we sort of loosen, you know, drop that yardstick, where the field of animal consciousness is going to become much more interesting.
Yeah. Let's take some more calls now. Uh-huh. We go next to McLean County, a listener on line two. Hi.
Hi. I happen to be one of those people who love crows, and here's two examples of animal intelligence that maybe are good yardsticks. One is problem solving, and the other is humor. A couple of years ago, my mother was putting out some Easter eggs for my nephews, and she was hiding them in the backyard, and she noticed that there was a couple of crows kind of sitting around in trees watching.
Uh-oh.
She went inside, she sat down, and a few minutes later, she looked out the window, and she saw a crow on the deck fence with something in its mouth. And when she went over to the window to look, this crow had stolen one of her Easter eggs. So the crow obviously watched her hiding an Easter egg, realized
yes.
that it might be a food substance, and was able to find it, pick it up with its beak, and then fly off with it.
That's wonderful.
So there's a problem to be solved, and the crow was able to solve the problem. I thought that's one measure of intelligence. We live in our backyard. We've got a set of utility lines right over the backside of our property, and we've got several beagles. And we had a family of crows living right in our area, and it seemed like when they got bored, they would fly and land on the utility lines, and then they would caw and caw. The beagles would come running outside, and the beagles would run around barking like crazy, and the crows would just, they were laughing. They were laughing at these stupid beagles running around barking their heads off. So to me, that's some good evidence that there is definitely some intelligence going on there. And, you know, they knew what they were doing. That was not an accident. They were having fun with those dogs.
I like your idea of a crow sense of humor. And, you know, crows and ravens are two birds for which the scientific literature has admitted play as a valid category of behavior. So we usually think of play as being reserved for just the highest, most intelligent animals. And we now know that ravens and crows do play. And I do think that you're right, that they have a sense of mischief. There have been stories that researchers told about how when they're, you know, climbing up to view crows, that crows will take pieces of fruit or pine cones and drop them on their heads. And I think they like to pester dogs, which I'm sure they view as lesser creatures.
And I know that there are some other animals that have that sense of play. Dolphins are probably the first one that come into my mind. Mm-hmm. But there are probably other animals that are willing to play with other species. I guess maybe that's the big standard. You know, that's the real mark. If you can play with other species, that suggests that the ability to play as a sign of intelligence is not just a primate thing.
Exactly. And when you mentioned dolphins, I mean, that's an example of how we usually, because dolphins are another group that we think of as highly intelligent. So until now, we've only thought of play in animals like that. And so admitting that crows and ravens play is a wonderful step forward in the ornithological literature. Mm-hmm. And that's a great story. But, you know, it's something, because it's really funny. It shows one of the ways that science sort of, by an unwillingness to admit anecdote into the literature, and there are good reasons for that. It's one of the ways that science can sometimes lag behind just the observations of the lay naturalists, you and I, who can go out and see on the sidewalk that crows are doing these things. You can't get them to do it again. You can't get them to do it in a way that will become statistically significant and admitted into the scientific literature, but they're doing these wonderful things that we can see and enjoy and make alive in the telling of the tale.
Mm. I want to thank the listener for calling in today, and now we're going to take another call. We've got a couple of folks waiting. Let's go next to Champaign County, Line 1. Hi.
Yes, hello. I enjoyed his story. It made me think of the second story about crows that an elderly relative of mine told me when she was very young, and she just recently died at 99. So it was long before my time, but she had a crow virtually as a pet, but it was a wild crow. And it sort of took her on. It followed her to the windows, and he would look in the windows at her, and then he would follow her to the garden and watch what she did out there. And when she hung clothes on the line, he didn't annoy her anyway, but he would talk and look at her, and he just seemed to enjoy her company. And the rest of her life, she wished she had had some sort of bird like that she could have had as a pet, because she certainly enjoyed him. But what I wanted to tell you about is crows that I have learned to meet, because I live out in the country on a heavily wooded lot. And I have about 5 or 6 crows that hang around most of the time, but they're doing just one pastime. When I hear them and hear them making a lot of noise, I know that it's worth my time to go out and look, because what they're doing is usually following a hawk. And I wondered if this was ordinary behavior that's often observed. What they do is seem like they do not like him. They follow him from tree to tree to treetop and will sit in an adjoining tree as a group and continually make noise at him and then ever encroach a little farther. I've never seen them make any contact, but they eventually, over a period of maybe a couple of hours, will get him to fly off completely, and that seems to be what they want.
Yes, that's a great question, and it's a very common crow behavior. Crows regularly mob any kind of raptor, whether it's a hawk or an owl, that comes into their line of sight, and they'll call other crows in to help with the mobbing. And the reason that they do this, it seems very bold, because oftentimes the hawk or owl is much larger than the crows, right? But they do this because raptors are prey upon crows, adult crows at night during their sleep, and especially on young crows at the nest or when they're naive, you know, first-year, hatchier birds. Crows and hawks are one of the worst predators upon crows when they're young, and so they gang up on them. Same reason they gang up on raccoons. Raccoons prey also at crow nests regularly. So it's common all over the world for crows to mob raptors. And but you're right. One of the wonderful things about your story is that you suggest that when you hear crows out there cawing all of a sudden, it's worth our while to go out and see what's going on, because it's usually something, some kind of news of the wild universe that's worth our while to take a look at.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Next, we take a call from a listener in Champaign waiting on line three. Hi.
Hello. This may fall outside of what you looked into for your book, but I'd like to pursue the issue of avian intelligence from a different angle. It's long been said that that birds were more or less direct descendants of dinosaurs. And while dinosaurs are typically depicted or thought of as not having highly developed intelligence, I'm just wondering if any of the researchers, you know, you looked at were sort of, you know, reverse engineering or looking back and rethinking the intelligence of at least some species of dinosaurs and thinking that maybe they were more intelligent than they think they might have been, or at least some of them.
Oh, absolutely. You know, the connection in, you know, recent decades of the evolution of birds and dinosaurs has really opened up and expanded our thinking of dinosaurian intelligence. Absolutely. Because before, you know, how we thought of them as sort of sluggish, cold-blooded, slow-moving creatures, now we realize with the connection to bird life that there's that quick-moving, fast paced, predatory instinct, warm-blooded creatures. So, yes, there is definitely a continuity there in the way we think about the connection between birds and dinosaurs and a rethinking of dinosaurian intelligence. Wonderful field.
Want to follow up there?
Just, that thought occurred to me, and I just wondered, you know, how much research there'd been in that area.
You're right that it's outside the scope of my work, but the dinosaur people are on it, and you're right, and that connection is, you know, one of the elements of the new thinking about dinosaur intelligence.
Well, thanks for the call this afternoon. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest today, writer and naturalist Lyanda Lynn Haupt, her latest book, Crow Planet, Essential Wisdom from the Urban Wilderness. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions or comments. Maybe you've got a crow story. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. That's 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. These birds have been very successful living side by side with us. They're a bird that has adapted to the urban environment. Why?
Oh, right. That's a great question. One of the reasons is their intelligence, because it takes a lot of a lot of flexibility to live in an urban place where just about every day a lot of different things can be thrown at you. You know, so they have that sort of flexibility of behavior that allows them to adapt to the newness, the continuing newness of an urban environment. But one of the other things is there's been this evolution. I don't want to say evolution, that kind of biologically. What I mean is there's been sort of an association between humans and crows since we started becoming an agricultural country here in the United States. When we started planting, converting our prairies to corn, that was an invitation to crows to start moving into the cities and the towns. When people in the towns started carrying guns and shooting crows, crows left the town. So there was this time when we were building up human communities and crows and humans remained separate because they knew that if they came too close to the human habitations, they would get shot. Then as the human habitations became denser, of course, people weren't allowed to carry guns around anymore, and the crows moved back in. And by removing native habitat and replacing it with concrete and McDonald's and human refuse and garbage cans that are full of food topped with ill-fitting lids, we're really creating crow havens. One of the reasons is that there are so many species that that crows would normally have to compete with for food are much less comfortable living in this environment. They're smaller, they're more sensitive, they have more restricted diets. So the more concrete we make, the more human refuse we produce, the more crows we make at the same time. And at the same time, of course, we are crows are a sign of, I mean, it's wonderful. I try to paint both sides of the picture. The good side of crows among us is that they make us realize that we always live in the presence of a more than human world. The harder side is that they're likewise a symbol of ecological imbalance, because the more crows there are, the more we remember that the rich diversity of species is becoming less and less. So I like to think of them as a reminder on both of those levels, to a reminder that we can more graciously inhabit our more than human world, both by paying attention to what's here and remembering what is lost.
One expert told you he estimates in the U.S. there's one crow for every family.
Right.
Would you tell our listeners how you imagine that come dinner time?
I think about the crow. I think about a crow, a chair with a crow perched on the back of it, waiting for us to bring it a plate of spaghetti. Our crow, our one allotted
crow. Our
crow,
yeah.
Because usually they say there's a crow nests in urban places. The territory for a pair of nesting crows is 2 or 3 urban yards. And so that's, you know, a couple of adults and a couple of young. So that works out to about one crow per family.
Yeah. Well, here's something interesting. While lots of crows live in cities, it seems they prefer to breed and nest in the suburbs or out in the woods.
That's right, and that's based on some research. That's here in the Pacific Northwest, so that research hasn't been extrapolated to all crows in all places. And I should mention the researcher is Dr. John Marslap here at the University of Washington, and one of your callers mentioned some research in which it was determined that crows recognize human faces, and that was Dr. Marslap's research as well here in Seattle. So one of the things that he found out about crows is that there are more crows here in Seattle in the winter than we can account for by the numbers of nesting crows here in the summer. So what they figured out is that in the spring, a lot of the crows that live here in the winter fly out to the suburbs to make their nests and raise their young. Now, not all of them by any stretch. There are a lot of crows still nesting in urban places, but a number of them go to the suburbs for the same reason, presumably, that humans go to the suburbs, because there's bigger yards, there's lots of grass with good worms, there's good now I know that we're not going there for the worms, but I'm saying that the quality of life from the crow perspective, there's good fresh roadkill, more raccoons and possums and fewer rats. So they go to the suburbs, they have their young, and the understanding is that the young birds come back here. Crows don't breed until they're 3 or 4 years old, so they spend their, feckless youth eating rats and potato chips and McDonald's French fries here in the city, and then go back to the suburbs to raise their young.
Yeah, and then after they've fledged and they're sort of in that adolescent stage, it's like, let's go to the city.
Exactly.
Let's take some more calls. A listener in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Hi there. This goes back to the topic of intelligence. A few years ago, I saw it was terribly sad, a dead crow in a parking lot, and another crow near it just cawing and cawing as if it was very sad and crying over this other dead crow. I didn't know if they had emotions like that, as elephants do, I think.
You know, that's a lovely question, and this is one of those things that I was talking about that kind of that space between what we can observe as lay observers and what's accepted as science. And this is one of those anecdotal stories that we hear over and over about crows, but that still is accepted only in the realm of story. We hear about the way that crows typically respond to death of other crows that they know in two ways. One is that they will gather near the crow and caw and caw and then leave the area in kind of an eerie silence. And another observation, and this is what people have come to call crow funerals, and I hear these stories over and over again, even from people that don't pay attention, claim that they don't pay attention to nature, that they're just kind of urban people who have never cared about birds. And I've heard people talk about being out on their day, and all of a sudden they'll see a small group of crows gathered in such deep silence that they're affected by it. The human is affected by it and stops to see what's going on. And what they find is that a circle of crows is gathered around, either on the ground or sitting above, low in a tree, a crow that has died. And they will gather in this way for some minutes before, and up to, even I've heard up to a half an hour, before flying out of this meditative silence. So, we do think that although the going notion is that ravens, the larger corvid, are more intelligent than crows, we know that they can problem solve at a higher level, that their play is more complicated, that because crows gather in larger social groups, that they have something that ravens don't have, which is this kind of social intelligence that allows them maybe a kind of justice and perhaps a respect for kind of loosely organized respect for the dead. So, yeah, that's a wonderful question.
Yeah.
Go
ahead.
I was just going to say one of the things that comes up in these calls and that I love about crows is that I bet the majority of your listeners today have a crow story. So our close habitation with this wild animal invites us into this very ancient way of knowing and sharing knowledge, which is the story. And I think that although I like to arm myself with good science, and I really think that people need to respect their own intelligence and realize that we can understand, you know, what the science, we can read scientific journals and understand what's going on there, and that's good to do. But we can also take our biological education, our education about the life and world around us, into our own hands by paying closer attention. And crows, because they're so visible, because they're so easy to watch, they invite us into that kind of attentive intimacy and remind us that it's not just about crows, but that there's, you know, another layer of wild animals and organisms and another layer beneath that that we can start to become aware of.
Yeah. We have to wrap up here, unfortunately. I hope that we'll have you back on the show another time to talk more about crows and other birds as well. But here we have to wrap up because we're coming down on time, and this might be a good way to wrap up here. At the outset of your third chapter, subtitled Crow Stories and Animal Alphabets, you quote Joan Halifax on the importance of stories. This is page 65. Would you share that epigraph, that passage with us?
I will. And Joan Halifax is a Buddhist, American Buddhist teacher and writer. And she says, "Storytelling is the most ancient form of education. It is about the remembering, making, and sharing of images that bind together time, nature, and people. Stories, like the sacred plants, are medicine and food, come from the earth. They remind us that we do not stand alone. Through them, we live in the body of coyote and crow, tree and stone. In this way, we confirm our relationship with all of creation."
Those are the words of Joan Halifax, quoted in Crow Planet, Essential Wisdom from the Urban Wilderness. And one last question. How would you suggest we begin to look more closely at the wildlife in our urban landscapes?
You know, I like the idea of approaching our day as a field trip. You know, instead of thinking of binoculars and a notebook and pencil to write down nature observations as something we do when we, you know, pack up and go to nature, just to invite that sort of expectancy regarding the natural world into our everyday life, to go out ready to see. And I promise you that if you go out with that sort of air of wonder, that more will be given.
Mm. So put a little pencil and a notebook in your pocket and put the binoculars on and go for a walk.
Exactly.
Yeah, and maybe binoculars one day will become a fashion statement.
I hope. I tried. I think that they might.
Okay, very good. We've got to leave it there. Lyanda, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
Oh, thank you for having me. My pleasure.
Lyanda Linhaupt is the author most recently of Crow Planet, Essential Wisdom from the Urban Wilderness, the book is published by Little Brown.